Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Karen Cam Radio Show. The intention of this show is to empower and inspire you to manifest the life of your dreams, whether it's radiant health, prosperity, loving relationships, or simply peace of mind. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Cam, author of the number one bestseller, Guide to Healing Chronic Pain, A Holistic Approach. And if you're one of the ones that has not read my book, you can get the first six chapters free as a download. Just go to my website, karencan.com, and put your name and email address in the little box. And I'll send you a link where you can download a free excerpt of my book and get five of my Fast Track Your Healing classes. And you can just access them anytime. I'll give you the password and the whole bit, and you can watch them. So, and also join me on Facebook. I'm really, really into Facebook. I just posted some really cool brain stuff yesterday. And so I'm really excited about today's interview. Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson is with me today, and she's going to be talking about, you know, how people are always wanting to lose weight, New Year's resolutions. You know, I thought this would be great to have her on because, you know, here is someone who, and I really respect people who have gone through, you know, their own issues and then have been able to create something for other people struggling with similar issues. And she's a tenured psychology professor. Okay, she's got letters after her name, okay? And I'm really into brain balance. A lot of you have been following me for a while. Know that. I, you know, measure it in various different ways. And she's going to share kind of like the neuroscience of weight loss. And so many people think they have to have the willpower, and they know they have food addiction, sugar addiction. Now, I happily am not one of those. My weight issues are kind of on a spiritual nature, so I'm one of the weird ones that, you know, can eat perfectly and all that kind of stuff and still, you know, have slight weight issues. But for the grand majority of my patients, it's struggling with sugar, you know, struggling with sugar, struggling with caffeine, struggling with alcohol, and thinking about food all the time, struggling with, you know, they want to be fit and they want to be, you know, they want to eat the right things, but then they can't make themselves do it, and it's really, really difficult. And the process that I use, you know, the emotion code, the body code, to help people release that, you know, it takes a while. It takes some layers, definitely, and it helps. But I asked Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson to come today to share her program that she's been doing. She's the founder of Bright Line Eating Solutions. If you go to her website, SusanPierceThompson.com, and that's Susan Pierce, spelled P-E-I-R-C-E, and then Thompson.com, you'll actually see some amazing photos and footage of the last year of the people have gone through her program that has released the weight and continue their really healthy eating patterns. And what Dr. Thompson loves to say is it's not about willpower. It's not about willpower. It's a whole slew of other factors that have to do with the way your brain processes data. And the way we've been thinking about eating in the past is kind of like old hat. It just doesn't work. And why is willpower simply not enough? And there's something called the food susceptibility scale that you can actually take and find out what kind of nutritional plan would work best for you. So I'm so excited to have Dr. Pearson on the show today. And again, you can go to our website, SusanPierceThompson.com. Okay, Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson, hello, hello, welcome.
Hey, thank you. It's so great to be on your show. It's neat to be live. I think this might be the first live radio show I've ever done.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, speaking of that, a little later when I'm done with my questions, we'll let people call in too. And if they have a question to ask you, we'll ask that everyone calling in, please call in from a real phone line because we have had some crank calls in the past. And we want to know where you're calling from. So give us a call, 818-514-1190. Again, 818-514-1190, and just hit 1, and then you'll be we'll unmute you at the appropriate time, and you can ask your question to Dr. Susan. So tell us a little bit about your story. It's actually pretty interesting, like how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Karen. Yeah, it's been a long, circuitous route, that's for sure. I was kind of a normal weight kid, maybe a little chunky, but by the age of 12, I was definitely overweight. And I have, for better or for worse, often for worse, an incredibly addictable brain. And I started experimenting with drugs and alcohol at the age of 14, and in short order, I got really hooked. And one of the things I loved about drugs in particular is that they would help me not think about food so much and help me lose weight. And I got hooked, pretty hooked, on methamphetamine, crystal meth, and then later cocaine, and then finally crack cocaine. And I ended up, even though I was a very good student when I was going, I ended up dropping out of high school, and my life took a pretty dark turn there for a few years. Very, very luckily and mercifully, I did get clean and sober at the age of 20, just a few days after my 20th birthday. And I knew I would whack on a ton of weight when I did, and I did. I got fat like in a breath. It felt like to
oh
me.
Boy.
And struggled with food pretty much from then on. And you know, a 12-step program helped me to get off drugs and alcohol, and I tried different 12-step solutions for food and wasn't able to kind of recreate the magic that had worked for me with drugs and alcohol. And did finally, actually, but it was, you know, a good 8 years after I first started trying. And so I just basically became sort of a student of food addiction and what it takes to overcome it, just mainly in the laboratory of my own life. But meanwhile, after I got clean and sober, I enrolled in community college, and I just want to give a plug to community colleges. Thank God for community college, because if it hadn't existed as a high school dropout, I don't know that I would have, you know, a career today or any of the letters you mentioned after my name. So I went to community college, did well, transferred to UC Berkeley, got 4.0s, spoke at the graduation ceremony, went to get my PhD in brain and cognitive sciences, finished that degree, did a postdoc in Australia for a couple years. And, you know, all through this, my own food addiction was an ongoing challenge. And so I was really studying what goes on in the brain when someone can't, you know, control the food that they're putting in their mouth. I mean, bending your elbow and lifting an ice cream spoon to your lips is a pretty, it feels like a very volitional act, you know. And I couldn't understand why I seemed to have so little control over when I would do that and how much I would eat and so forth. So I finished my postdoc. I came back to the States, and I ultimately ended up getting tenure in psychology, and I taught a college course on the psychology of eating for a bunch of years. And so I also did finally, you know, let go of all my own excess weight. I went from a size 16 to a size 4. That was 12 and a half years ago, and I remain a size 4 to this day. So I learned through my studies that actually, that places me among the top 0.01% of successful weight loss maintainers. Almost nobody who is obese. And
that's
I was technically obese. I was like barely in the obese category, but I was obese. At 5'3", I clocked in at obese. And almost nobody loses all their excess weight and keeps it off for a decade or more. So, so basically then I just, not that long ago, decided to spread what I learned to a wider audience. So I started an email distribution list, and now that email list is up to like 125,000 people. And so I just share the psychology and neuroscience of sustainable weight loss with anyone who wants to know about it, basically. So that's kind of what I'm up to.
That's fantastic. And we gave your URL earlier, and people can put their name and email address and get tips from you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, there's a quiz if people want to take a quiz, because what I find is that people who struggle with their weight often are trying solutions that aren't tailored to how their brain works. Like, my brain is very addictable. So if I'm going to do something, it's got to be a solution tailored more toward food addiction. Other people who don't have addictable brains really just need to watch their portions or exercise more. You know, there's other types of solutions. Those solutions don't work for me because my brain is just too addictable. It's not about calories in, calories out for me. It's about food addiction. So I devised a quiz that I call the food freedom quiz, because once you know how susceptible your brain is to food addiction, then you understand your best path for food freedom. And so, yeah, so if someone wants to take that quiz, they can do that. That's at quiz.brightlineeating.com. So Q-U-I-Z dot bright, B-R-I-G-H-T, line, L-I-N-E, eating, E-A-T-I-N-G.com. So if someone's kind of curious about my stuff, that's probably the most fun way to enter into the Susan Beer Thompson Bright Line Eating world, because that quiz will give them a whole bunch of information right up front about what they're dealing with.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I really love quizzes like that, and because it engages people and they have something that's more personal to them. And I think with weight loss and Chinese medicine is very much individualized, you know, which is very difficult sometimes to do studies on. Because in Western medicine, we do this placebo-controlled thing, and we treat everybody the same. And in Chinese medicine, no, like one person might say, well, dairy is good for you, another person that's not good for you, and one person cold foods are good, and the other person, no, you can't eat cold foods, you know, and, you know, all these kind of things. So if you can individualize it, it's really helpful. So what give us some examples of, so for people, and there's definitely people in my, you know, in my patient list that have that highly addictable brain. So if they're not eating, they're doing something else that's, you know, addicting. What's going on in the brain? Like, why is it that they don't have that quote unquote willpower?
Yeah. Yeah. So those are actually two separate questions. Let's take the first one first, the question of what's going on in the brain that causes that addiction and those cravings, and then also that makes someone sort of switch addiction. So if they're not, you know, overeating, they're smoking cigarettes. If they're not smoking cigarettes, they're gambling, whatever, shopping,
yeah,
you know, too much caffeine, too much alcohol, whatever. And what's going on there is usually just the downregulation of the dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens. So that's like a lot of fancy words, which basically boils down to, in what we call the reward and pleasure center of the brain, which is this circuit that includes this little part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, dopamine is the primary neurotransmitter at work there. And the dopamine gets released in order to motivate us to continue to seek out certain rewards, like food and sex, for example. And that's pretty important to have hardwired into the brain, because anybody who didn't have an underlying bias towards getting food or procreating wouldn't survive, right? So the dopamine, people talk about it as pleasure, as a pleasure neurotransmitter. But actually, I was at this conference once with this professor from NYU Medical School, and he... You know, when you do research, you have to get IRB approval, which means that you have to, like, if you're going to do research on human subjects, you have to get approval to do it. But you don't have to get approval to study yourself. You can do whatever you want yourself in America, right? So he found a way into his brain and created a drip of dopamine into his nucleus accumbens and, like, cut into his skull. And we were all sitting there in the audience, like, with our jaws dropped. We were just like, wow, this dude is hardcore. So, and he reported back to us. He said, I'm here to tell you that it doesn't feel like pleasure. It doesn't feel like pleasure. What it feels like is more. I want more of that. I got to go get me more of that. And he would stand there in his laboratory pressing a button to keep dripping dopamine into his nucleus accumbens, like, all day and all night. He had to have a lab tech there to save him, basically to force him to stop and go home to his family. He said it doesn't feel pleasurable. It feels like you've got to do it again. That if you don't do it again, the world is not going to be okay. You must do it again. He said it's the most powerful drive and motivation to act that he'd ever experienced. Now, interestingly, what happens is with the frankenfoods that we've got today, these convenience store foods, movie theater, snack bar foods, you know, vending machine foods, you know, pizza foods, whatever, all these foods, right, that we have today, we didn't used to have foods like this. We've taken real food substances and perverted them and turned them into drugs in the same way that we took coca leaves and poppy plants and turned them into heroin and cocaine. We've taken the inner essence of these plant-like substances and turn them into drugs, namely sugar and flour. And when these foods hit our system, they flood the brain with so much dopamine, that part of the brain, that, first of all, it triggers us to want more. But second of all, that part of the brain was never designed to get that big of a rush of dopamine. There's no way, for example, to eat like a candy bar's worth of sugar, 100,000 years ago. Like, you just couldn't. The berry bushes would get ripe, but that's all you had was raspberries.
Right.
And, you know, the honey was being guarded by the bees. And, you know, like, you just couldn't procure that much. So we've basically got food porn today. It's sort of the equivalent of how pornographic images are the distillation of sex to a degree that we just 100,000 years ago never could have gotten exposed to. It's just not something that was possible to get that kind of intense stimuli. So these foods hit that part of the brain, and a big flood of dopamine comes in, and you do that again, and you do that again, and what happens is that part of the brain responds by down-regulating or sort of thinning out the dopamine receptors. So what happens then is the world feels bleak unless you eat that way some more. And that's something that I think people fail to realize, is that the addict isn't using to get high. The addict is using to feel normal.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
In that state of dopamine depletion, anything that produces a dopamine rush will do. Like, if you're on a diet, so you've taken the food away from yourself, well, then you better go, you know, smoke some cigarettes, drink some caffeine, watch some pornography, go to the mall and spend a bunch of money that you don't have and can't afford, so that gives you a sort of an excited rush, whatever. There's lots of ways to get a dopamine rush. So that's why addicts switch drugs often. If access to one drug is cut off, they'll just do just about anything to get that dopamine rush.
Mm.
Yeah, that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's actually one of the young people that was a patient in the office a while back had questioned me, a young male, about, porn and dopamine. And he said, I found this really interesting article, and I think, you know, this might be a problem for me, and I need to just stop cold turkey or whatever, you know, to get these dopamine receptors back. And I'm like, huh? You know, it was kind of foreign to me. And I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. You know, and you know, and so many of our young people have various different things. And I think that one of my other patients, also a male, actually works in the processed food industry. He's not the healthiest person, I have to say, and he doesn't come to see me except maybe once a year for emergencies. But what's really interesting is he knows some insiders, and he said to me, Do you know about the addictive effects of maltodextrin? And I'm like, maltodextrin? I think that's just like a powdery substance that thickens things. And he's like, no,
yeah.
My friend works in the industry, and he said that's supposed to addict you to the food, the chips, all the stuff I sell. And I'm like,
yeah.
What? And I'm looking, I couldn't
find
anything on it.
Yeah, I think maltodextrin is chains of dextrose molecules. Isn't it like six dextrose molecules chained together? It's basically sugar.
I don't know. You can make it out of corn, I suppose, and then my issue is, you know, is it GMO corn, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I know there's some non-GMO maltodextrin, but I'm sure that some of the perversions of it do not have to be labeled as such, because we don't have rules about labeling that kind of, you know, thing in our processed food. I find that if I'm going to be addicted to something, it's going to be potato chips. I love the crunch and I love the salt.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I noticed that if there is like Torula yeast in there, some sort of yeast extract that's like an MSG kind of thing. And I come from an Asian culture where, you know, if you go out to eat, MSG is in almost everything. Excitotoxin, you know, it excites your brain and kills some brain cells. But I noticed that sometimes I was like, wow, I can't stop eating this. You know, which is why I try not to have it in the house.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like,
totally.
Ooh.
Totally.
Yeah. And normally I don't see myself as much of a, you know, I do have, I think everybody has kind of little mini versions of their addictions. And mine's probably, you know, working on the computer and my business, because I'm so passionate about it. So my husband's always laughing at me. He's like, well, you're laughing at my sugar addiction, but look, you're on the computer again. You're working again. Yeah. I love coming. I love what I do. You know. So we all have our little highs. But, yeah. So I don't know if there's any other food substances that you've tested or heard of that nobody knows generally that they're supposed to be addictive besides sugar and alcohol and flour.
I think flour. People underestimate the addictive property of flour. So, for example, pizza is always in the top three most addictive foods. Ice cream, chocolate, and pizza are usually in the top three. And I always say to people, what is it about pizza that's so addictive? And then I tell them, look, you know, yes, cheese has a slightly addictive molecule in it called morphocasein. So the casein in cheese is a little addictive. However, put cheese and sauce on broccoli, and you now have, you know, a yummy snack that people might eat as a side dish at an Italian, you know, dinner, but nothing that anyone's going to, like, you know, be, you know, dreaming about and ordering out at 2 a.m, you know. Pizza is addictive because of the dough. And when you actually ask people what foods they crave, sugar and flour pretty much dominate the list. So it's either sugar foods, you know, like candy and ice cream and all that stuff, or it's bread, chips, crackers, pizza, pasta. So in my experience, this isn't research, this is just my sense, having worked with now thousands and thousands of people, helping them to lose weight and to get, you know, free from addictive food. My sense is that about 80% of people prefer sugar or sugar flour fat combinations. And about 20% of people really are the flour variety. They literally will look you in the face and say, I could give two whits about sweet stuff, but don't take away my bread.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take away my
bread. Yeah,
I've
heard
crackers,
that.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah. And so
wow.
People talk, a lot of books these days are talking about sugar, fat, and salt as the addictive foods, and I really like to disabuse people of that notion. There was a really powerful paper published just recently that looked at fat versus sugar in flooding the nucleus accumbens with dopamine. It was an fMRI scanning study. They put people into fMRI machines and scanned their brains as they ate a milkshake that was either titrated to be high in sugar or high in fat or both. And what caused the flood in the nucleus accumbens was only high sugar. High fat had no additional effect. As a matter of fact, fat was irrelevant in the addictive response. So we have pretty solid evidence that fat is not addictive. It's sugar that is. Now, sugar is often paired with fat. What fat does is it makes food more palatable, so you'll eat more of it. Like, yeah, if you're served broccoli plain or broccoli with salt and fat, you know, buttery salt on the broccoli, people will eat more of that broccoli, but they won't binge on it and then, you know, again, like, leave their house in a snowstorm at 2 a.m. to go get, you know, buttery, salty broccoli. But they will do that.
Right.
So it's So it's not sugar, fat, and salt. It's sugar and flour. Those are the addictive. And the reason potato chips are addictive is that the inside of a white potato is pretty much the only natural substance that mimics flour almost exactly. It's basically just glucose chains with no fiber to offset the glucose hit. So French fries and potato chips sort of count as flour, essentially, molecularly. They're almost identical. With French fries and potato chips, and, you know, chips, crackers, pizza, and then all of the sugar foods, you basically have the sum total of the addictive foods. Again, cheese is a little addictive. Some people, and then there's some interesting things. For some people, meats are addictive. I think there's individual differences.
Did you say meat?
I love how you talked about, meat. I love how you talked about Chinese medicine being individualized, because I think there's actually a lot of research to be done about individual differences and what people find addictive and what people don't. I think there's individual differences there. So I hate to make sweeping generalizations, but if I do, I think sugar and flour cover the most ground for most people. And, you know, what you said that your advice was to that guy, that kid that was worried about pornography addiction and worried about his dopamine receptors, what you said is that, you know, she's got to lay off to let them heal. And that's exactly right. Like, the dopamine receptors do replenish. They do heal. And so if you stop flooding the brain with dopamine, you have a chance at healing. And, you know, like, letting those cravings loosen up their holds, they essentially fade away to food thoughts that you can easily brush aside. And, you know, I talk to people about using bright lines for food instead of striving for moderation. Because, you know, it's interesting to me that with other addictive things, we don't tend to advise moderation. Like, if your friend is smoking 2 packs a day, you tend not to, like, advise them to cut back and do a better job of moderating their nicotine consumption.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's a
you'd
really
say,
good
dude, you
got
to quit. When are you going to quit smoking? And, you know, I think our society's become more understanding of people who at New Year's Eve say no thank you to the champagne and they say, I don't drink. You know, yes, even on New Year's Eve, I don't drink. You know, some people need to not drink alcohol. And I think that our society needs to get a lot better at understanding that for some people, not eating sugar at all, not eating flour at all, is going to be their best path to health.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's really interesting. Now, I want to ask you 2 questions. I want to go back a little bit about the potato chips, since that's my thing. If I'm going to have a craving, it's that thing. So you're saying that, so say you have a potato chip cooked in, I don't know, coconut oil. I know this Honest Chip brand is, like, pretty impressive to me. You know, they've got blue potatoes, you know, cooked in, you know, so-called healthier fat, coconut oil or palm oil, organic, whatever. So when your body digests it, it acts the same way as what the flour would do if I ate a pizza?
Yeah, and this is a really important point. So I get pushed on this a lot with people who are misunderstanding the intent of what I'm expressing. What I'm expressing has essentially nothing to do with health. So there are ways of preparing those potato chips in a healthier way. And yes, it is healthier to have a potato chip that's cooked in healthier fats as opposed to genetically modified soybean oil. Yes, that's healthier. What I'm saying is it doesn't matter at all to the dopamine receptors in your nucleus accumbens. Like, that white potato hits that part of the brain and it's going to cause that flood. And what that's going to do is it's going to set you up for cravings later. So here's an example. This is a classic example of where health and addiction considerations totally collide. Juicing. Green juice.
Ah,
people love
great
their
topic.
Green juice. Yeah, people love their green juice. And yes, it is true that if you put all kinds of spinach and alfalfa and pineapple and apples and celery and whatever you want to put into your juicer, and that green juice comes out, what you've got there is carbohydrates, like, you know, fruits and vegetables that are completely stripped of their fiber, or you've put it in a blender so the fiber is lacerated. You're making a smoothie. So basically there's no fiber lattice network to blunt the rush of that fructose and glucose straight into your bloodstream, that flood of dopamine into the nucleus accumbens. And while you have a lot of nutrients coming on board in a big bolus that's really, you know, healthy with antioxidants and everything, you have now set yourself up to have cravings later on for ice cream or for whatever, potato chips, whatever your drug of choice is when it comes to food. And so for that reason, even though juicing is healthy in terms of the antioxidants and the big bolus of nutrients that it provides to your system, for people who struggle with their weight or struggle with cravings for food, I recommend that they don't juice and blend their food. Health has got nothing to do with it. It's about addiction,
right?
It's about what's going to result in healing your brain so that you're not being led around by cravings to eat foods that, you know, aren't supporting you in your long-term goals to be what I call happy, fit, and free. If you want to be happy, fit, and free, and you struggle with it, you're going to have to start thinking in terms of long-term addiction scenarios as opposed to just thinking about health. Luckily, health, of course, is a byproduct of getting all this handled. You know, you become incredibly healthy when you're happy, thin, and free. But it's not for aiming for health. It's aiming for, achieving sort of a more bright line lifestyle. It's like the quitting smoking thing. You know, ultimately, when you quit smoking, you get healthy.
Right, exactly. Now, if somebody, say, I mean, obviously if they have severe addiction problems, then, or, you know, their brain is wired that way, then the juicing, the blending the food, that's not going to work for them. It'll, like you said, set them up for issues later on. If someone's moderate, we'll say moderate, have moderate addictive brain, if that's the term, could they, like, if they wanted a smoothie or something like that, could they, like, put a ton of fat in it, like, to, like, slow down the absorption? Would that help at all? Like MCT oil,
that's an interesting
oil
question.
Or ghee, I've done that before, or avocado, just because it's, like, more fatty, you know, monounsaturated fat.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Because the smoothie thing works for me, but again, I don't have that high addictive brain that other people do. So that will last me hours and hours and hours, and I don't get cravings, you know, food cravings.
Right.
Right.
And this is why knowing where you are on the food freedom, you know, quiz is so important. Like, how susceptible your brain is to the addictive pull of food is so important to know. Because if you're, you know, you're saying you're moderately to low on the susceptibility scale, basically, you're not that susceptible to addiction. And so knowing that about yourself, you can now say, you know what, smoothies and juicing, they work fine for me, especially if I add some fat in there, then it lasts me for hours and hours. I don't get hungry. It's awesome. And this is exactly the point, is that, you know, the advice that we give people is almost always from our own viewpoint. It's from, this has worked so well for me. And because we're a human being, they're a human being, we assume that it's going to work well for them. And this is one of the biggest points that I want to disabuse everybody of, is that whatever works for you with your food and your exercise and your health is not necessarily going to work for someone whose brain wires differently than yours. And so I really encourage people to sort of think of things in those terms, especially when it comes to addictive susceptibility. Some people's brains are just really finely attuned, and they adapt and respond and wire more readily. And that means their dopamine receptors thin out and they become driven in ways that other people just aren't driven. Like, their brains just work differently.
Gotcha. And we have a question here about, in the chat, about corn. So is that the same with corn chips, they're asking?
Yeah, corn chips are basically corn flour. And so those would not be great foods to use. So it's, you know, it's any kind of flour. It doesn't matter what kind.
It can be gluten-free flour. It could be spelt flour. It could be quinoa flour. Any sort of flour. How about, okay, somebody else says, what about coconut and almond flour? People are drafting at their flours here.
totally. I get that all the time. What about stevia? What about, In Bright Line Eating, what I recommend for things like coconut and almond flour is, first of all, I want people to know their susceptibility score. So are you a 10 or are you a 5? Are you a 1? So it's a scale from 0 to 10. And if I hear that someone's a 5 on the scale, I'll think, you know what, you might be able to get away with some coconut and almond flour. What I do is I have them do a Bright Line Eating plan pretty strictly for about 6 weeks and get their brain healed and cleared and get their thinking straight again, because, of course, eating the way people tend to eat these days creates quite a food fog, a brain fog. And then I have them reintroduce it and see if it works for them. That's the best way to go about that. But to answer the question, strictly on the Bright Line Eating plan, there's no flour of any kind. No matter what it's made of. With the caveat, that's what the Bright Line is, no flour of any kind. But with the caveat that depending on where you are on the susceptibility scale, you could potentially reintroduce it after your system has been cleaned to see how it works for you. I always say, I'm not the Bright Line Eating police. Like, I really never deny anyone their research, you know. Find out if it works for you. It doesn't work for me. I'm a 10 on the susceptibility scale. Like, I get away with nothing, unfortunately. And other people, you know, if you're a 5 or a 6, you might end up, you know, finding that it works fine for you.
So if somebody, more details here. So if somebody says, can I eat almonds if I can't eat almond flour?
Yeah, that's exactly the point, is that almonds are fine. Corn on the cob is fine. Almond flour is not fine. high fructose corn syrup is not fine. So it has to do with the refining process and how we modify and change that food. So when you take a plant-based substance and you grind it into a flour, what you do is you dramatically increase the surface area of the molecular exposure. So your digestive enzymes hit every surface inside of those tiny particles right away, and that leads to whatever is in there just being exposed into the bloodstream really quickly. And that's really the issue. So it's a processing issue. It's not, you know, I've got nothing against almonds. Almonds are great. As a matter of fact, I eat almonds all the time. But almond flour is a different beast than almonds. And that's the point, is that when we refine food, we fundamentally change how our body absorbs it.
Oh, yeah, that's a really, really important key point. And you know, my body's been telling me that for a while, too, and I didn't really understand scientifically why that was it. Like, if I even, you know, pulsed, like, I there was this great recipe for quinoa pizza, and I pretty much never eat pizza. I don't actually eat a lot of flour or baked goods or anything like that, but this sounded really great. I thought, oh, well, you know, my husband can eat it. He's gluten sensitive, so let's do the quinoa pizza. And you make these individual pizzas, and you soak the quinoa overnight, and then you pulse it, you know, and then you make the pizza. But I got to tell you, it was pretty much just as addicting as regular pizza, even though it was so cold, you know. Yeah, and I was like, wow, that's really interesting. I don't just want to eat the whole personal pizza all in one. You know, all in one thing.
Yeah. Totally.
And I'm like, geez. You know, but if I eat like, you know, my regular, like my broth with my you know, 2 cups of veggies and a meat and a dollop of ghee or whatever, I'm good. You know, I don't feel like I need to eat more, but when I make that pizza, I want to eat that whole pizza.
Yeah, totally.
Amazing. Just amazing. Yeah, that's really interesting about the increased surface area and how your enzymes and processing. Yeah, I never really, you know, quite got a handle of why. So, you know, even, you know, we buy stuff, you know, for birthdays or stuff like that, I'll make, like, you know, almond flour or cakes or whatever. But it's sort of like I keep looking at it going, I want another piece.
Yeah.
And I don't normally I could just, like, whatever. You know, I go to the store, I look at all this, you know, sweet bark, whatever's at the grocery store, and it's like, yeah, whatever, yuck, gross, you know, I'm not even attracted to that. But it's really interesting how it can really change the brain. So tell us more about the bright line eating and what's kind of involved. Like, we talked a little bit about, it's not about willpower. You really have to understand your brain's susceptibility, but doesn't it require willpower to actually stop eating sugar or flour?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, we haven't gone too far into the issue that it's not about willpower. I talk a lot about the science of willpower. People misunderstand and think of willpower as basically an extension of some combination of their character and their motivation or drive on any given issue. Like, if they've got enough backbone as a person and this issue means enough to them, then they will, you know, they will have the will to really carry out the behavior that matters to them. And it turns out, unfortunately, that's just not the way the brain works. Willpower is carried in the anterior cingulate cortex, which is part of the brain right behind the prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, behind our forehead, basically. And it really loses its ability to function through exertion of any number of varieties. So resisting temptations, making decisions, regulating emotional responses, task performance, that sort of thing. So these are all like buzzwords, but let me just like break that down for you. Making decisions. That's like checking email. You're looking in your email inbox and you're thinking, what is this email telling me? What do I care? Am I going to delete it? Am I going to file it? Am I going to respond? And there's like 8 decisions you have to make to process one email successfully. And then you go on to the next one. So after 15 minutes of that, your willpower shot. And now you're thinking that you want something to nibble on and you have no capacity left to make a decent food choice. So the thing is that, unfortunately, and actually to any like chronic dieter or someone who really has struggled with their weight like I did for so many years, it should start to make sense, actually, that just wanting something really, really badly and having the capacity to be successful in lots of other areas of life really has no bearing on your ability to lose weight. You know, I call this the Oprah paradox. I mean, you know, you can't get more successful, more comfortable with success, more motivated, more ambitious, more self-actualized, right? I mean, Oprah's amazing. And yet, for all these years, she struggled with her weight. And it's really interesting that weight loss as an issue doesn't succumb to the typical profile, where the smarter you are and the more accomplished and the more resources you have at your disposal and the more you want something and the more you learn about it and the more you care about it, the more likely you are to triumph and be successful in that area. And weight loss isn't like that. And so willpower basically is setting us up to fail. If we rely on willpower, we won't be successful. But your point is really well taken, that to stop eating sugar and flour takes an enormous amount of willpower. And so in order to make all that work, because Bright Line Eating really does work, I mean, last year we helped people lose 43,000 pounds, and we have a lot of people, we have a lot of people all the way down at goal weight. Like, I'm not sure when exactly, but at some point I'm going to call the Guinness Book of World Records and ask, you know, them to add a new category of, like, the most people living at goal weight on any given way of eating.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Who used to be overweight or obese, right? I mean, people who have always been slender, you know, shouldn't factor into that equation. The trick is to, if you have been overweight or obese, to lose all your excess weight and keep it off long term. That's sort of the holy grail, right? So how do you set up a Bright Line Eating system if willpower is going to be so fickle and not necessarily on call when you want it to be? And the answer is you need to build in habits and structures that take the load off of willpower. And that is a very multifaceted behavior modification program, essentially. There's a lot to it, and that's what I teach in my Bright Line Eating Bootcamp. It involves automating and systematizing your eating in the same way that you brush your teeth twice a day every day without having to put sticky notes on your mirror to remind you. I think about 95% of at least the American population brushes their teeth twice a day.
Doesn't really
matter if it's New Year's Eve and you're out late, you come home, you still brush your teeth before you go to bed. Almost everyone brushes their teeth twice a day. And we accomplish that without using any of our willpower. And the way we do that is because it's become completely automatic and that it's cued by time of day cues and location cues that trigger us to do it in a very routinized way. And this is one of the reasons I recommend breakfast, lunch, and dinner with nothing in between, because breakfast, lunch, and dinner are automatizable in much the same way that brushing your teeth is automatizable. There's a lot to it. But, you know, if someone wants, like, a couple quick and dirty tips, never make food choices in the moment. So before the day has begun, the night before, you should, after dinner, go to the fridge, keep a little book, a little journal by the fridge with a pen, and write down exactly what you're going to eat. I mean, exactly, to the baby carrot, what you're going to eat the next day. And then the next day, your job is just to eat only and exactly that. And you've got to, you know, pack some of it up and bring it with you. I mean, that doesn't mean that like, I never eat out. Of course I eat out. And so in my journal, I would just write, you know, I'm going to eat out with friends and I'm going to have a Bright Line meal. But that's like Bright Line Eating 201. Like in my boot camps, I recommend at the very beginning, for a little while, don't eat out. Like just get used to what it's like to do it at home and start to build in automatic habits. But it takes about 66 days on average for new behaviors to become automatic. There's a huge range in that. So 66 days is very much sort of a rough and dirty estimate. But, you know, my boot camp lasts about that long because that's what it takes to get a new system up and running. And while you're doing that, it takes a lot of support. And, yeah, it's going to take a lot of willpower. And that's why I recommend that people don't exercise when they're losing weight. That's a very different recommendation than you get from most people.
Right, right.
Succeeding at weight loss is basically a game of getting the food right. Nobody loses weight and keeps it off long-term because they exercise. You've got to get the food right. And when you're trying to set up your automatic habits around food, you don't have any extra willpower to burn, and exercising burns up a lot of willpower. People don't realize how willpower-intensive exercise is. So if people are wondering why only 0.01% of people actually succeed at the weight loss game, I think some of that is that we've got some built-in assumptions in our society that are exactly wrong. And one of them is that diet and exercise should go together. Exercise is what you should do after you lose your weight. That's what you do for the rest of your life. Like, weight loss should be a very specific, targeted time in your life. Do it once, get that weight off, get it off fast, and then exercise for the rest of your life, but not while you're in the weight loss phase.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that because, I've been reading a lot of books about, the different evidence out there, and there isn't any really great evidence that diet and exercise really work. Like you said, it's mostly failures, and so people always have it drummed in their head by their doctors, of course, as well, because that's what we're told in the medical field to do and tell people to do. Oh, you're not exercising enough. And so people will come, I have somebody that I know who definitely had excess weight to lose, and she's just exercising herself crazy, like just crazy, like to the point where I think she's getting depleted. I'm really worried about her. She has some joint issues now, and just, and she's very stressed at work. And so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this isn't really the simplest way to do it, but they've been drummed into their heads. It's about diet and exercise. Now, of course, if someone is already exercising, it's already a habit, it doesn't take extra willpower. You're not telling them not to exercise, during their weight loss, right? Just that you don't want to add that in to the Bright Line eating program.
That's a subtle distinction. And theoretically, like, let's imagine that someone has a habit that the minute they wake up in the morning, they go down to their basement, get on their treadmill, and they jog for 20 minutes. And they've been doing that every day for 15 years. And it's as automatic as brushing their teeth. Then, theoretically, my advice would not apply to them.
Okay. Yeah. So if they say, it makes me feel good. If they say it makes me feel good, I have more energy, I feel good about myself, then I wouldn't necessarily want them to say, well, stop that, just focus on the food.
Well, that's another challenge is, like, some people come to me with anxiety and depression, and exercise is one of their frontline, modes of treatment for that. And so those are a couple of exceptions where I say, keep exercising. I do really emphasize, though, making people aware of the hit to their willpower, and how much harder it's going to be for them to succeed. Because one of the other things about weight loss is it makes you exhausted. During especially the beginning of the weight loss phase, you've got a lot of things working against you all at once. One is that most of the toxins in your system are stored in your fat cells. So as they shrink, those toxins get dumped into your bloodstream. Your whole system is running pretty high in terms of toxicity. Excuse me. And then, another issue is you've just stopped eating enough calories to sustain your body weight by definition. That's why you're losing weight. So when that happens, your metabolism slows down a little bit. So you just feel pretty sluggish. And then you're burning fat for a lot of your fuel, and fat is a really dirty fuel compared to fresh carbohydrates. Burning fat releases a lot of extra things, and your whole body is metabolizing your fuel in a very different way. So losing weight is exhausting, and people often find that they need to rest a lot more than they anticipate. Again, we're just talking about a few weeks, though. Like, weight comes off really fast. Like, my friend Pat, 200 pounds. He went from 375 to 175, and he did it in 16 months. So he had a lot of weight.
Wow.
But even still, we're talking about a relatively small proportion of this man's life. My friend Joe lost 125 pounds, went 325 down to 200, and did that in 10 months, super fast.
That's amazing that they can do it that fast.
Yeah, I lost my weight 60 pounds in 6 months. So again, we're talking about a relatively short period of time, and I just like to invite people to think of weight loss in a really different way. There's another benefit to not exercising when you lose weight, and that's proving to yourself that it really is all about the food. It's all about the food. So, like, when my weight pops up by a couple pounds, which it does sometimes, I know that I need to make changes in my food. It never dawns on me to go for a run. Even though I do exercise and I like to go for jogs, I have broken permanently in my mind the exercise-weight association, which is appropriate. They should not be associated. That run is not going to help me get off those 2 pounds. What's going to help me get off those 2 pounds is making lighter choices for the next day or two. And really, even one day would do it in my food plan.
Oh, amazing. So give us a quick example of, like, what would somebody eat that would be on the Brightline food plan?
So one thing about the Brightline eating food plan is it's really agnostic about fat and protein. I know people argue about fat and protein a lot, but, you know, whether you like to eat meat and dairy and that's important to you, or you prefer to be whole foods plant-based and that's important to you, Brightline eating works equally well. So you can basically do paleo or whole foods plant-based and do Brightline eating. It works just as well.
Oh, great.
So that said, So that said, you know, people can construct their food plans very, very differently. The basics are no sugar, no flour, eating only at meal times, which for 95% of people is 3 meals a day with nothing in between. And then bounding the quantities either by weighing and measuring with a digital food scale or using like a one plate of food rule and just being careful to have a policy of not going back for seconds. So those are the essentials of the program. What I eat is like, I like to have oatmeal in the morning. You know, I make my oatmeal with soy milk or almond milk, and then I sprinkle a bunch of ground flax seeds on top of that and some nuts, and then have a bunch of berries or other fruit, banana or whatever. For lunch, and I used to eat, you know, Greek yogurt and oatmeal and fruit. That used to be what I ate, but I stopped eating dairy a while ago. And then for lunch, some kind of protein. So, whatever floats your boat. If you're plant-based, you might want to have beans or tempeh or something like that. If you like meat, you know, some kind of chicken or shrimp or fish or steak or hamburger, I mean, whatever, cheese. And then vegetables, and then fruit, and then some kind of fat, you know, olive oil on your salad or whatever. And then for dinner, And let me just say also that when you get all the way down to goal weight, you'll add grain into that too. So for lunch, you'd have some rice or some quinoa or something like that, sweet potato. And then for dinner, yeah, a bunch of vegetables, protein, big salad, fat. That's basically what people who do Brightline eating eat.
Okay. Well, that's fantastic. We have one question here about stevia. You mentioned it before. Does that actually mess with your dopamine receptors because it's sweet?
Does what mess with the dopamine receptors?
Eating stevia, like, does it cause or contribute to the addiction because it's sweet, even though it's not high glycemic?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a couple different mechanisms by which sweet things affect our system. One is through our glucose system. So if you eat sugar, it's going to, you know, deliver that bolus of sugar to the bloodstream, and that's going to raise insulin levels, and it's going to, you know, contribute to metabolic syndrome and stuff like that. Excuse me. But the other pathway is actually straight from the taste buds, and this is where stevia comes in. So the taste buds do two things. First of all, they do connect up to the dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens, so it is going to increase that flood there. But then the other thing is that the taste buds actually, through classical conditioning, create an insulin response in advance. So even if you don't have glucose that's being delivered or fructose that's being delivered, what happens is the taste buds assume that sugar is coming to the system and they trigger a release of insulin in advance. Yeah, exactly. So anyone who's looking to recover from any kind of sugar habit or any kind of weight issue is going to want to eliminate anything that they add to their food to make it sweet. Now, fruit is fine as long as it's eaten at a meal. Like, I wouldn't recommend eating a bowl of pineapple by itself.
Right.
But if you eat your fruit at a meal, it's got enough fiber to blunt the response and et cetera. But so, yeah.
Okay, great answer. You know, it's funny because I've always suspected that. I was like, gee, you know, if your brain thinks you're having something sweet, and even though you've tried to trick it and say, well, it's not really sugar anymore, it's stevia, it's supposedly healthier. Other, you know, authors have said if you eat too much stevia, you're really training your taste buds to want that sweetness. You'll always have that addiction. And I was thinking, you know, maybe, yeah, because I had a time where I was doing everything with stevia because I was trying to figure out a way to, like, you know, make stuff that my patients would actually still eat, you know, and somewhat healthier. But I know for myself, I was like, you know, if that's true, I don't think I should be eating stevia every day. So I just totally cut back. And actually, it's very rare that I use that now. But that's what I was thinking. I was like, I wonder if your insulin response actually goes up anyway, because it kind of thinks that you're eating something sugary. So thank you for that validation.
Sure.
Now, we just for the couple of minutes we have left, I want to make sure people know how to get involved with your Bright Line Eating Program. Where do they go? What do they click on? How do they start?
Yeah, good question. It's all through email. So, you know, I don't have a link on my website where you can register for my boot camp. People who are on my email list get exposed to everything I do. I send out emails about what's going on. I send out a weekly video blog on different topics and stuff. So the best thing to do if you're interested in what I've been talking about is just to join the Bright Line Eating movement. Just join the email list and just see what it's like. You can always unsubscribe at the bottom of any email. And if you are interested in the boot camp, being on the email list is the only way to hear about it. So there's lots of ways to join my email list. You can go to my website. I would recommend taking the quiz, though, because you want to know where you're at on the susceptibility scale. So that link, again, is quiz.brightlineeating.com. BRIGHTLINEEATING.com. Quiz.brightlineeating.com.
Okay, perfect. And why did you name Bright Line Eating anyway?
Bright lines. Yeah, bright lines are clear, unambiguous boundaries that you just don't cross. And so, you know, if you're going to quit smoking, you throw up a bright line for cigarettes. If you're going to go into AA and stop drinking, you're going to have a bright line for alcohol. And I think again, because food, you know, sugar is so much more addictive than cocaine. People don't realize. You give rats intravenous cocaine.
Right.
You addict
I love
them
that.
To intravenous
that.
Cocaine. They prefer sugar water. Even if they've never been exposed to sugar before and they're addicted already to cocaine, they prefer sugar over cocaine. People don't realize how addictive it is. And so when we're dealing with real addiction, bright lines are really the best pathway to freedom for most people. So, I just really want to get the idea out. Plus, I think bright lines are just such a cool concept because a lot of us are often putting up boundaries between ourselves and other things, whether it's our ex-boyfriends or it's, you know, using computer screens after 11 p.m. or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if we want to throw up a bright line for something, I think it's helpful to have that vocabulary in place.
Yeah, that's great. Well, a lot of clarity. Well, definitely it's going to help me with counseling my patients. Thank you so much for what you do, Susan.
It's fantastic. Dr. Karen, that's been great.
Yeah, fantastic. And what I normally do is I create a pretty link. So I have, to our this particular conversation, I'm going to create what's called a pretty link so that when I want to email my patient or give them the resources, when I type up their summary notes, then I just give them that pretty link so they go directly to this conversation so they can, you know, hear what you had to say. And there, like I said, there's definitely a proportion of people that have that addiction, that high susceptibility, and that need some extra advice. So it's so great to have people like you out there, you know, in the field doing work. And I know we don't have time to discuss it, but you have a not-for-profit arm too. And congratulations for all the successes that you've had personally, professionally, and now, you know, helping people out with this nonprofit. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Karen. It's been great talking with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time, bye for now. Take care.